You are listening to a sermon by Janet Bolt, recorded on Sunday, January 21st, 2024, at Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speakers are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Good morning. I find myself more nervous than usual, and maybe you'll understand as I carry on here. Some of you know me quite well, and others perhaps have not even met me. Yet this congregation is where I have felt safe and nurtured for many years. This morning's meditation is of a more personal nature. There was Jonah, a foreigner wearing strange clothes, speaking a strange language, and standing on the streets of Nineveh. We can imagine a reporter from Nineveh Times coming up to him with a question: "What are you doing here?" Likely Jonah might have wanted to say, "Oh, you can't believe what it took to get here. I've been in the stinking belly of a whale, and it wasn't me who even wanted to come. God told me I had to come and to tell you that you're all going to die." Scripture cryptically describes what he said: 40 days and Nineveh will be destroyed. I think perhaps Jonah might have been a bit more persuasive than what is recorded here, because it seems there was an immediate response to this strange message. The people of Nineveh repented and turned to God. In 1978, after a brief but successful career as a high school English teacher, God called me to Nineveh. In my case, Nineveh was Fresno, California, and my streets were in a Hispanic neighborhood, euphemistically called the Devil's Half Mile, and an African-American housing project on the south side of the city. What was I doing there in Fresno? This white foreigner, raised as an Anabaptist, a middle-class Canadian with strange manners and strange ways of speaking, wandering the streets of Fresno's inner city. I took up residence with several others in a home on the Devil's Half Mile. What was I doing there? In 1978, Fresno and surrounding areas had a population of 400,000, with ghettos, as they called them then, pocketed throughout the city. The city was tense with racial battles between Hispanic and African-American gangs. The Mexican Mafia initiated gang members in our neighborhood at age 14 and were responsible for many of the shootings and the knifings in the city. Fresno was like Nineveh. And God had called me, along with three others, to walk the streets as bearers of God's name. Frankly, as a missionary, I had set out to convert my neighbors. I hoped that by genuinely sharing God's love through word and deed, they might repent as the Ninevites did and turn to God. I was a foreigner, teaching the Bible to children, youth, and adults, providing opportunities to go to camp and to be employed. Because I lived there, I was available 24 hours a day to minister to the urgent needs of the community. The assumption was that we possessed valuable skills and qualities that others lacked. During these 12 years, I had to raise my own financial support. And our means of doing this was through writing monthly letters to our supporters, sharing with them the needs that we witnessed and how we were called to meet them. I wrote over 140 of these letters. After 12 years, my life there came to an abrupt halt and I left Fresno. That is its own story. But I am older now, and my understanding of faith, of conversion, of a call to ministry, and the impact of cultural change all have influenced how I understand my own story. I lived then with a common theological paradigm that I possessed the truth and I was called to share it. But I have come to humbly recognize that I am a pursuer of truth, and I am not and never have been in possession of it. In the last 2 years, I've had several surprising encounters with women I first met when they were 6 years old in my Hispanic neighborhood. Meeting them has taken me on a journey of rereading many of these prayer letters I sent so long ago. As I've read them, I've found myself chafing at how they were framed from the perspective of what we as a ministry team were doing. I realized quickly how distorted that narrow perspective was. Whose story was it to tell? Certainly not mine. And what was missing was how much I had been changed by those I was ministering to. Truly, life in Fresno for me was not about gifts that I was able to give. It was about a gift exchange. So I decided to rewrite some of these letters from this perspective, and I would like to read several of these stories to you today. First one is called Maria Maria. Picture one of these young women whom I recently met again as a six-year-old named Maria, running around my neighborhood. Here is my retelling of that part of the story. Recently, we were in California to visit our children and decided to connect with a few people I had known in Fresno many years ago. I made plans to meet my friend Elvia and her daughter Lizzie at a restaurant. When I arrived there, I was delighted to see that Elvia's aunt, Maria, was there as well. Maria giggled when she saw my delight. I had not seen her in years. She drew me close to her and said, "I am who I am today because of you." I first met Maria in 1978 in our neighborhood called the Devil's Half Mile because of the rampant gang and drug activity. Her mother and sister, her niece Elvia, who was two at the time, and two brothers lived down the street from me. At age six, Maria began attending our after-school clubs right away. She instantly became my translator as I tried to navigate life in this Hispanic neighborhood. I affectionately called Maria my shadow. She seemed to follow me everywhere and went to hang out at our home after school. She'd wash dishes with me, clean the house with me, go on errands with me. She would spend the night at my house whenever she could. One late afternoon, several years after I had moved to Fresno, there was a knock on my door. There stood Maria and her friend Lynette, looking very serious for their 8 years of age. They told me they had some questions to ask me. "Who made God?" they began. "And does God really know everything? Like, how come God makes things that bite, and animals that scare, and people who get sick and die?" The questions kept coming that afternoon. Once again, Maria became my translator as I tried to navigate deep theological questions from two very curious little girls and speak about things that I didn't even understand. At 4'6", Maria was wise beyond her years, with a radiant smile and engaging laugh. She was a lot of fun to be around and a hard worker. She went on to help us with our youth clubs and take responsibility for teaching Bible stories to the younger kids. She sang in our small choir and performed in her little dramas that we would present in the neighborhood. She, along with a large group of boys and girls in our community, went to summer camps in the Sequoias, took trips with us to Disneyland and Los Angeles, and met people from all walks of life. As we sat beside each other in this Greek restaurant in Fresno, over 40 years later, Maria recounted what I, along with my team, had taught her. "I am who I am today because of you," she said. "I've told the lawyers in the firm where I work all about you, and they'd like to meet you. Would you come?" We did, but not before she surprised us by paying the bill at the restaurant with a joyful flourish. "Maria, Maria, all that you are has shaped me. I went to your neighborhood to bring God's love, and it is through you that I discovered it more fully." The second story is called Eddie. Picture a young Hispanic boy growing up in my Fresno neighborhood, already a fighter. I didn't know. I didn't know when he bit my arm and tightly clenched his jaw that he was the one hurting. I didn't know that while I screamed for mercy, he was the one yearning for it. We were in my neighborhood called the Devil's Playground, and 6-year-old Eddie was already notorious. The day I met him, a hot San Joaquin wind swirled dusty garbage through the back alleys. Eddie stood 3 feet tall and held in his fist the caps off the four tires of my car, now flat. "I'm 14 years old," he said, "and I've been living in this neighborhood on my own for 24 years." Every day, Eddie would fend for himself. His mother had almost died of a heart attack after one brother blew up a homemade bomb in her kitchen. The other brother was serving time for armed robbery. The local school had given up on Eddie. Before the day even got started, he would curse, swear, and hit whoever crossed his path. He would be sent home only to find the door locked, his mother and brother gone. He would settle himself on his front steps and keep himself company. I watched him with combined compassion and dread. My home was the center for an after-school initiative program designed to keep kids out of trouble. Eddie was already trouble. Sometimes I'd invite him in to come over during the day to do some coloring and make crafts. I had good motive. Could I find a way to coach Eddie into some semblance of cooperation so he could stay in school? When I resisted his demand for milk and cookies that hot day, in a flash, his jaw was clenched on my upper arm, and I was in agony. Like a bulldog, he held on tight. I didn't know he was the one hurting. Helpful hands extricated my arm, and a cold compress was applied. Eddie grabbed a crayon and scribbled on a page or two. Minutes later, I walked him home and turned away to head back down the street. Suddenly, he lunged from behind. Eddie had reached in for a hug. Story number three, Lily Mack. Picture a poor, lonely, elderly white woman living in this troubled Hispanic neighborhood. Her name was Lily. What an odd context for friendship. Lily sat on the front steps of her apartment, her head in her hands, weeping. I noticed her when I walked to visit a friend in my neighborhood. As I came up her sidewalk, I asked, "Can I sit with you?" She mumbled a response. Lily looked to be in her 80s, sparse gray hair, patched and wrinkled skin, with an old cane leaning against her leg. She didn't appear to be physically injured, but her frustration was palpable. She had been robbed. Her welfare check had arrived on time, and she had painfully walked to the nearby convenience store with anticipation. Making her slow way home with her purse and a small bag of groceries, she encountered a local gang who snatched both her purse and her groceries and sent her stumbling home. She was frightened, but also angry. This had not been her first experience of being robbed in her own neighborhood. I returned an hour later with groceries for Lily and helped her put them away. She groaned with dismay as I entered her little kitchen and avoided the scurrying cockroaches. When I opened her fridge, a deeper groan escaped. No need for words. Her aging and lonely existence was told in the half-eaten and crusted bits of food. I realized soon that Lily was partially blinded by cataracts and knew little of the true state of her home or her fridge. Over the months and years following that first encounter, a gentle friendship and companionship developed between us. Lily was often ill and lonely. Groceries and house cleaning helped, but more often a sit-down visit was needed. One autumn day, I arrived to find the apartment empty and locked. I knew of no family, so no one could tell me where she was. We desperately called our neighbors, and someone had seen an ambulance. A call revealed she was in hospital. Weeks later, she was moved to a care facility. Lily and I continued our visits. Her humor often caught me off guard. "I eat like a sieve, don't I?" She winked and pointed at her spotted dress. Her warm, though mostly toothless smile and undaunted optimism became her gift to me each time I visited. I needed her. At a little memorial for Lily a year later, I finally met a distant family member. She didn't know Lily. She had sadly missed all the little treasures I had gained. And she didn't know what I knew. Lily Mack had a friend. She had been loved. I had been loved.